through their actions. And all it took was a little bit of Archie's imagination and two phone calls. The first call had been to Renault, the second to Janza. But Janza's call had been simply routine. Archie knew he could shape Janza's actions the way he could shape a piece of clay. But the call to Renault had required the right moves, resourcefulness, and a little touch of Archie in the night. Shakespeare yet, Archie chuckled. The phone must have rung, 50 times, and Archie hadn't blamed the kid for not rushing to lift the receiver. But persistence paid off, and finally there was Renault on the line. The quiet hello, the calm voice, but something else, something else. Archie had detected another quality in the voice, a deadly calm, determination. Beautiful. The kid was ready. Archie had soared with triumph. The kid wanted to come out and fight. He wanted action. "Want to get even, Renault?" Archie goaded. "Strike back? Get revenge? Show them what you think of their goddamn chocolates?" "How do I do that?" The voice was guarded, but interested. Definitely interested. "Easy, easy," Archie responded. "If you're not chicken, that is. The needle, always the needle." Renault was silent. "There's a guy named Janza. He's really a rotten kid, no class at all. He's not much more than an animal. And word has gotten around that he needed the help of a bunch of kids to make you fall in line. So I figure we ought to settle the matter. At an assembly, at the athletic field. Boxing gloves, everything under control. Here's a way to get even with everybody, Renault. With you too, Archie?"
"Me?"
The voice innocent and sweet. "Hell, why me? I was only carrying out my job. I gave you an assignment. Don't sell the chocolates. And then I gave you another. Sell them.
You did the rest, kid. I didn't beat you up. I don't believe in violence. But you touched off the fireworks."
Silence on the line again. Archie pressed on, softening his voice, cajoling, leading him on. "Look, kid, I'm giving you this choice because I believe in fair play. Here's a chance to end it all and get on with other things. Christ, there's more to life than a lousy chocolate sale. You and Janza, alone in the ring, facing each other fair and square. And that's it. Finished. The end. All done. I guarantee it. Archie guarantees it." And the kid had fallen for it, hook, line, and sinker, although the conversation had gone back and forth for a while. Archie had been patient. Patience always paid off. And he had won, of course. Now, surveying his handiwork, the crowded bleachers, the frantic comings and goings as the raffle tickets were bought and sold, and the directions scrawled on the tickets, Archie exulted quietly. He had successfully conned Renault and Leon and the vigils and the whole damn school. "I can con anybody. I am Archie."
"Pretend you're a spotlight," Obi told himself. "A spotlight sweeping the place, stopping here and there and lingering at other places, picking up the highlights of the thing, this momentous occasion. Because let's admit it, this is an important event, and Archie, that bastard, that clever, clever bastard, has done it again. Look at him down there near the fight ring like he's king of all he surveys. And he is, of course. He's got Renault there, pale and tense as if he's facing a firing squad, and Janza, the animal, a chained animal waiting to spring loose."
Obi, the spotlight, concentrated on Renault. Poor, dumb, doomed kid. He can't win, and he doesn't know it. Not from Archie. Nobody wins from Archie. Archie, who had been going down to defeat. What a great scene that had been. The last vigils meeting when he'd stood there, humiliated. But now he was on top again. All the chocolate sold, in charge once more, the entire school in the palm of his hand. All of which proves that the meek don't inherit the earth. Not very original. Archie must have said it at one time or another.
"Don't move. Not a muscle.
Just wait. Wait it out. Wait and see." Jerry's left leg had fallen asleep.
"How can your leg fall asleep when you're standing up?" "I don't know, but it's asleep.
Nerves, maybe. Tension." At any rate, small darts stung his legs, and he had to fight to keep from moving. He didn't dare move, afraid he would fall apart if he moved. He knew now that it had been a mistake coming here, that Archie had faked him out, tricked him. For a few moments, while Archie's voice whispered enticingly of sweet revenge, suggesting the fight as a way of ending it all, Jerry had actually believed it was possible to beat Janza and the school and even Archie. He had thought of his father and the terrible look of defeat when he had listened on the phone the other night and finally placed the receiver on the table, giving up. "I'm not giving up," Jerry had pledged, listening to Archie's goading voice. He also ached for a chance to confront Janza, who had called him a fairy. So he had agreed to meet Janza in a fight, and already Archie had double-crossed him, had double-crossed Janza as well. He'd allowed them to be led onto the platform, stripped to the waist, shivering slightly in the evening air, given boxing gloves. And then Archie, his eyes sparkling with triumph and malice, had explained the rules. Those rules. Jerry had been about to protest when Janza opened his mouth. "It's okay with me. I can beat this kid any way you want." And Jerry saw, to his dismay, that Archie had counted on Janza's reaction, had counted on the guys filing into the stadium. He had known that Jerry couldn't back away now. He had come too far. Archie had bestowed one of his sickly, sweet smiles on Jerry. "What do you say, Renault? Do you accept the rules?" What could he say? After the phone calls and the beating, after the desecration of his locker, the silent treatment, pushed downstairs, what they did to Goober, to Brother Eugene, what guys like Archie and Janza did to the school, what they would do to the world when they left Trinity. Jerry tightened his body in determination. At least this was his chance to strike back, to hit out, despite the odds Archie had set up with the raffle tickets. "Okay," Jerry had said. Now, standing here, one leg half asleep, nausea threatening his stomach, the night chilling his flesh, Jerry wondered if he hadn't lost the moment he had said okay. The raffle tickets were selling like dirty pictures. Brian Cochran was amazed, but he shouldn't have been. He was getting used to being amazed where Archie Costello was concerned. First the chocolate sale, and now this wacky raffle. Never anything like it at Trinity, or anywhere. And he had to admit that he was kind of enjoying himself, even though he had protested when Archie approached him this afternoon, asking him to take charge of the raffle. "You did great with the chocolates," Archie said. The compliment melted Brian's opposition. Besides, he was scared stiff of Archie and the vigils. Personal survival, that's what Brian believed in. He had been seized by doubt again when Archie explained how the fight and the raffle would work. "How are you going to get Renault and Janza to do it?" That's what Brian wanted to know. "Easy," Archie assured him. "Renault's looking for revenge, and Janza's a beast. And they can't back down with the whole school looking on." Then Archie's voice had gone cold again, and Brian had shriveled inside. "You just do your job, Cochran. Sell the tickets and leave the details to me." So Brian had lined up a bunch of kids to do the selling. And Archie had been right, of course, because there they were, Renault and Janza, up there on the platform, and the tickets were selling like there was no tomorrow. Emil Janza was tired of being treated like one of the bad guys. That's the way Archie had made him feel. "Hey, animal," Archie would say. Emil wasn't an animal. He had feelings like everybody else. Like the guy in the Shakespeare thing in English 1, "Cut me, do I not bleed?" All right, so he liked to screw around a little, get under people's skin. That was human nature, wasn't it? A guy had to protect himself at all times. Get them before they get you. Keep people guessing and afraid. Like Archie with his rotten picture that didn't even exist. Archie had convinced him that there was no picture after all. How could there be a picture, Emil? Archie had reasoned. Remember how dim it was in the John that day? And I didn't have a flash. And there wasn't any film in the camera. And if there had been, I didn't have time to focus. The truth had both relieved Emil and made him mad as hell. But Archie had pointed out that Emil should be mad at people like Renault. "Hell, Emil, guys like Renault are your enemy, not guys like me. They're the squares, Emil. They're the ones who screw it up for us, who blow the whistle, who make the rules." Then Archie had provided the climax, the door slammer. Besides, the guys are starting to talk about how Renault was beaten up, how you needed the help of others and couldn't do it yourself. Emile looked across the stage at Renault. He longed for combat, to prove himself in front of the whole school. The hell with that psychology crap Archie had made him use, telling Renault he was a fairy. He should have used his fists, not his mouth. He was impatient to get started, to wreck Renault in front of everybody, no matter what was written down on the raffle tickets. And in a corner of his mind, there still lurked the doubt. Did Archie have that picture of him in the John after all? 36. Those raffle tickets. Wow, terrific. Archie hadn't seen any that had been filled out yet, and he stopped one of the guys who'd been recruited as a salesman by Brian Cochran. Let's see, Archie said, holding out his hand. The kid was quick to comply, and Archie was pleased at his submissiveness. I am Archie. My wish becomes command. The sound of the restless audience in his ears, Archie scrutinized the paper. Scrawled there, the words, Janza, right to jaw, Jimmy Demers. That was the simple, stunning beauty of the raffle, the unexpected twist that Archie Costello was famous for, what they always knew Archie could do, top himself. In one stroke, Archie had forced Renault to show up here, to become part of the chocolate sale, and he also placed Renault at the mercy of the school, the students. The fighters on the platform would have no will of their own. They would have to fight the way the guys in the bleachers directed them. Everybody who bought a ticket, and who could refuse, had a chance to be involved in the fight, to watch two guys battering each other while they were at a safe distance, with no danger of getting hurt. The risky part had been getting Renault here tonight. Once he was on the platform, Archie knew he could not refuse to go on, even when he heard about the tickets. And that's the way it worked out. Beautiful. Carter approached. "They're really selling, Archie," he said. Carter appreciated the fight concept. He loved boxing. He had, in fact, bought two tickets and had gotten a kick out of deciding which blows he would call for. He'd finally decided on a right cross to the jaw and an uppercut. At the last moment, he'd almost assigned the blows to Renault, give the kid a break. But Obi was standing nearby, Obi, who had stuck his nose in everybody else's business. So Carter had written in Janza's name. Janza, the beast, always ready to jump when Archie said jump. "Looks like a beautiful night," Archie said now, smugly, that know-it-all attitude Carter hated. "You see, Carter, I told you everybody was pushing panic buttons for nothing." "I don't know how you do it, Archie," Carter was forced to admit. "Simple, Carter, simple." Archie reveled in the moment, basking in Carter's admiration. Carter, who had humiliated him at the vigil's meeting. Someday he'd get even with Carter, but at the moment it was satisfying enough to have Carter regarding him with awe and envy. "You see, Carter, people are two things, greedy and cruel. So we have a perfect setup here. The greed part, a kid pays a buck for a chance to win 100, plus 50 boxes of chocolates. The cruel part, watching two guys hitting each other, maybe hurting each other, while they're safe in the bleachers. That's why it works, Carter, because we're all bastards." Carter disguised his disgust. Archie repelled him in many ways, but most of all by the way he made everybody feel dirty, contaminated, polluted, as if there was no goodness at all in the world. And yet Carter had to admit that he was looking forward to the fight, that he himself had bought not one, but two tickets. Did that make him, like everybody else, greedy and cruel, as Archie said? The question surprised him. Hell, he'd always thought of himself as one of the good guys. He had often used his position as president of the vigils to keep control of Archie, to prevent him from going overboard on assignments. But did that make him one of the good guys? The question bothered Carter. That's what he hated about Archie. He made you feel guilty all the time. Christ, the world couldn't be as bad as Archie said it was. But hearing the shouts of the kids in the bleachers, impatient for the fight to get underway, Carter wondered. Archie watched Carter drift away, looking troubled and perplexed. Great, burning with jealousy. And who wouldn't be jealous of someone like Archie, who always came out on top, Cochran reported. All sold out, Archie. Archie nodded, assuming the role of the silent hero. The moment was here. Archie lifted his head toward the bleachers, and it seemed to be some kind of signal. A ripple went through the crowd, a quickening of tempo, a sweep of suspense. All eyes were directed to the platform where Renault and Janza stood at diagonal corners. In front of the platform stood a pyramid of chocolates, the last 50 boxes. The stadium lights burned bright. Carter, gavel in hand, walked to the center of the platform. There was nothing to bang the gavel on, so he simply raised it in the air. The audience responded with applause, impatient shoutings, catcalls. "Let's go!" someone yelled. Carter gestured for silence, but the silence had already fallen. Archie, walking toward the platform for a close view of the proceedings, sucked in his breath as if he were sipping the sweetest of all events. But he exhaled in surprise and stopped in his tracks as he saw Obi walk on the platform carrying the black box in his hands. Obi smiled maliciously when he caught Archie standing there in surprise, his mouth wide open in astonishment. No one ever surprised the great Archie that way, and Obi's moment of triumph was a thing of beauty. He nodded toward Carter, who was on his way to escort Archie to the platform. Carter had been doubtful about using the black box, pointing out that this was not a vigils meeting. How can we make Archie try for the marbles? Obi had the answer, the kind of answer Archie himself would have given. Because there are 400 kids out there yelling for blood, and they don't care whose blood it is anymore. Everybody in the school knows about the black box. How can Archie back down? Carter pointed out that there was no guarantee that Archie would pull out the black marble. The black would mean he'd have to take on the position of one of the fighters. But there were 5 white marbles and only 1 black marble in the box. Archie's luck had held up throughout his career as the assigner. He had never drawn the black one.
The law of averages, Obi had said to Carter. He's going to have to draw 2 marbles, 1 for Renault, the other for Janza.
Carter had gazed steadily at Obi. We couldn't... His voice curled into a question mark.
We can't fix it, no way. Where can I find 6 black marbles, for crying out loud? Anyway, Archie is too smart. We could never con him. But we can throw one hell of a scare into him. And who knows, maybe his luck has run out.
Thus, the agreement. Obi would emerge with the black box at the moment before the drawings and the fight began. And that's exactly what he was doing now, crossing to the center of the platform as Carter went down to meet Archie.
You guys are really something else, aren't you?
Archie said, pulling away from Carter's grip.
I can walk up there alone, Carter, and I'll walk back again, too.
Archie's fury was a cold, hard ball in his chest, but he played it cool, as usual. He had a feeling nothing could go wrong. I am Archie. The sight of the black box stunned the gathering into a silence more deep than before. Only members of the vigils and their victims had seen it. In the garish stadium light, the box was revealed as worn and threadbare, a small wooden container that might have been a discarded jewelry box. And yet it was a legend in the school. For potential victims, it was possible deliverance, protection, a weapon to be used against the might of the vigils. Others doubted its existence. Archie Costello would never allow that sort of thing. But here was the black box now, out in the open, in front of the whole frigging school. And Archie Costello looking at it, reaching out his hand to draw the marble. The ceremony took only a minute or so, because Archie insisted on getting it over quickly before anyone knew what was going on. The less drama, the better. Don't let Obi and Carter build it up. Thus, before any protest could be made, Archie had shot his hand out and pulled a marble from the box. White. Obi's jaw dropped in surprise. Things were moving too fast. He'd wanted Archie to squirm. He'd wanted the audience to realize what was going on here. He'd wanted to prolong the ceremony, get as much of the drama and suspense out of the situation as possible. Archie's hand shot out again, and it was too late for Obi to prevent the action. He drew in his breath. The marble was hidden in Archie's closed fist. He held the fist out toward the audience. Archie held his back stiff. The marble had to be white. He hadn't come this far to be denied at the last moment. He let a smile play over his lips as he faced the audience, gambling everything in his show of confidence. He opened his palm and held up the marble for all to see. White. 37. The goober arrived at the last moment and made his way through the turmoil to the top of the bleachers. He'd been reluctant to come. He had washed his hands of the school and its cruelties and hadn't wanted to witness Jerry's daily humiliations. The school also reminded him of his own betrayals and defections. For 3 days he'd been home in bed, sick. He wasn't at all sure whether he'd really been sick or whether his conscience had revolted, infecting his body, leaving him weak and nauseous. At any rate, the bed had become his private world, a small, safe place without people, without the vigils, without Brother Leon, a world with no chocolates to sell, no rooms to destroy, no people to destroy. But one of the guys called up and told him about the fight between Jerry and Janza, and how the raffle tickets would control the fight. The goober had moaned in protest. The bed had become unbearable. He had tossed and turned all day, prowling the bed like an animal seeking sleep, oblivion. He didn't want to go to the fight. Jerry couldn't possibly win. But he couldn't stay in bed either. Finally, desperate, he had gotten out of bed and dressed hurriedly, ignoring the protest of his parents. He had taken the bus across town and walked half a mile to the stadium. Now he huddled in the seat, looking down at the platform, listening to Carter explaining the rules of the crazy fight. Terrible. And the kid whose written blow is the one that ends the fight, either by knockout or surrender, receives the prize. But the crowd was impatient for the action to begin. Goober looked around. These fellows in the stands were known to him. They were classmates. But suddenly they'd become strangers. They stared feverishly down at the platform. Some of them were yelling, "Kill him! Kill him!" The goober shivered in the night. Carter advanced to the center of the platform where Obi held a cardboard carton. Carter reached in and pulled out a piece of paper. "John Tussier," he called. "He's written down Renault's name," murmurs of disappointment, a few scattered boos. "He wants Renault to hit Janza with a right to the jaw." Silence fell. The moment of truth. Renault and Janza faced each other, an arm's reach away. They had been standing in the traditional pose of fighters, gloves raised, ready for battle, but a pathetic parody of professional fighters. Now Janza followed the rules. He lowered his arms, prepared to take Jerry's blow without resistance. Jerry hunched his shoulders, cocked his fist. He had been waiting for this moment ever since Archie's voice had taunted him on the telephone. But he hesitated now. How could he hit anyone, even an animal like Janza, in cold blood? "I'm not a fighter," he protested silently. "And think of how Janza let those kids beat you up." The crowd was restless. "Action! Action!" someone called, and the cry was taken up by others. "What's the matter, fairy?" Janza taunted. "Afraid you might hurt your little hand hitting great big Emil?" Jerry sent his fist sailing toward Janza's jaw, but he had swung too quickly, without sufficient aim. The blow almost missed its target, finally brushing Janza's jaw ineffectually. Janza grinned. Boos filled the air. "Fix!" someone called. Carter motioned to Obi to bring the box out quickly. He sensed the impatience of the crowd. They had paid their money, and they wanted action. He hoped Janza's name would be on this slip. And it was. A kid named Marty Heller had ordered Janza to hit Renault with a right uppercut to the jaw. Carter sang out the command. Jerry planted himself like a tree. Janza got ready, insulted by the cries of "Fix!" "Just because Renault was chicken. I'm not chicken. I'll show him." He had to prove that this was a genuine contest. If Renault wouldn't fight, then at least Emil Janza would. He struck Jerry with all the force he could summon, the impact of the blow coming from his feet, up through his legs and thighs, the trunk of his body, the power pulsing through his body like some elemental force until it erupted through his arm, exploding into his fist. Jerry had girded himself for the blow, but it took him by surprise with its savagery and viciousness. The entire planet was jarred for a moment, the stadium swaying, the lights dancing. The pain in his neck was excruciating. His head had snapped back from the impact of Jans's fist. Sent reeling backward, he fought to stay on his feet, and he somehow managed not to fall. His jaw was on fire. He tasted acid. Blood, maybe. But he pressed his lips together. He shook his head, quick vision-clearing shakings, and established himself in the world once more. Before he could gather himself together again, Carter's voice cried out, "Jansa, right to the stomach!" And Jansa struck without warning, a short, sharp blow that missed Jerry's stomach but caught him in the chest. His breath went away, like it did in football, and then came back again. But the blow had lacked the power of the uppercut. He crouched again, fists erect, waiting for the next instructions. Dimly he heard the crowd, both cheering and booing, but he concentrated on Jansa, who stood before him, that idiot smile on his face. The next raffle ticket gave Jerry his chance to strike back at Jansa. A kid Jerry had never heard of, someone named Arthur Robillard, called for a right cross, whatever that was. Jerry had only a vague idea, but he wanted to hit Jansa now to repay him for that first vicious blow. He cocked his right arm. He tasted bile in his mouth. He let his arm go. The glove struck Jansa full face, and Jansa staggered back. The result surprised Jerry. He had never struck anyone like that before, in fury, premeditated, and he'd enjoyed catapulting all his power toward the target, the release of all his frustrations, hitting back at last, lashing out, getting revenge finally, revenge not only against Jansa, but all that he represented. Jansa's eyes leaped with surprise at the strength behind Jerry's blow. His immediate reaction was to counterpunch, but he held himself in control. Carter's voice. "Jansa! Left uppercut!" Again, the quick, jolting, neck-snapping pain as Jansa, without pause or preparation, struck out. Jerry backpedaled weakly. Why should his knees give way when the blow struck his jaw? The guys were shouting from the bleachers for more action now. The noise chilled Jerry. "Action! Action!" came the shouts from the audience. That was when Carter made the mistake. He took the slip of paper Obi handed him and read the instructions without pausing. "Jansa, low blow to the groin!" As soon as the words were out of his mouth, Carter realized his error. They hadn't warned the crowd about illegal punches, and there was always a wise guy out there ready to pull a fast one. At the words, Jansa aimed for Jerry's pelvic area. Jerry saw the fist coming. He raised his fists and looked toward Carter, sensing that something was wrong. Jansa's fist sank into his lower stomach, but Jerry had deflected part of the force of the blow. The crowd didn't understand what had happened. Most of them hadn't heard the illegal instruction. They only saw that Jerry had tried to defend himself, and that was against the rules. "Kill him, Jansa!" a voice cried from the crowd. Jansa, too, was puzzled, but only for a moment. Hell, he'd followed instructions, and here was Renault, the chicken, breaking the rules. The hell with the rules, then. Jansa let his fists fly in a flurry of violence, hitting Renault almost at will, on the head, the cheeks, once in the stomach. Carter withdrew to the far side of the platform. Obi had fled the scene, sensing disaster. Where the hell was Archie? Carter couldn't see him. Jerry did his best to build defenses against Jansa's fists, but it was impossible. Jansa was too strong and too fast, all instinct, sensing a kill. Finally, Jerry covered his head and face with the gloves, letting the blows rain on him, but waiting, waiting. The crowd was in a turmoil now, shouting, jeering, urging Jansa on. One more shot at Jansa. That's what Jerry wanted. Crouching, absorbing the attack, Jerry waited. There was something wrong with his jaw. The pain was intense, but he didn't care if he could hit Jansa again, renew that earlier, beautiful punch. He was being hit everywhere now, and the crowd noises leaped to life as if someone had turned up the volume on a monstrous stereo. Emil was getting tired. The kid wouldn't go down. He drew back his arm, pausing a moment, seeking true aim, wanting to come up with the final, devastating blow. And that was when Jerry saw his opening. Through the pain and his nausea, he saw Jansa's chest and stomach unprotected. He swung. And it was beautiful again. The full force of all his strength and determination and revenge caught Jansa unguarded, off balance. Jansa staggered backward, surprise and pain rampant on his face. Triumphantly, he watched Jansa floundering on weak, wobbly knees. Jerry turned toward the crowd, seeking, what, applause? They were booing him. Shaking his head, trying to reassemble himself, squinting, he saw Archie in the crowd, a grinning, exultant Archie. A new sickness invaded Jerry, the sickness of knowing what he had become, another animal, another beast, another violent person in a violent world, inflicting damage, not disturbing the universe, but damaging it. He had allowed Archie to do this to him. And that crowd out there he had wanted to impress, to prove to himself before. Hell, they wanted him to lose. They wanted him killed, for Christ's sake. Jansa's fist caught him at the temple, sending Jerry reeling. His stomach caved in as Jansa's fist sank into the flesh. He clutched at his stomach protectively, and his face absorbed two stunning blows. His left eye felt smashed, the pupil crushed. His body sang with pain. Horrified, the goober counted the punches Jansa was throwing at his helpless opponent. 15, 16. He leaped to his feet. Stop it! Stop it! But nobody heard. His voice was lost in the thunder of screaming voices, voices calling for the kill. Kill him! Kill him! Goober watched helplessly as Jerry finally sank to the stage, bloody, opened mouth, sucking for air, eyes unfocused, flesh swollen. His body was poised for a moment like some wounded animal, and then he collapsed like a hunk of meat cut loose from a butcher's hook. And the lights went out. Obi would never forget that face. A moment before the lights went out, he turned away from the platform, disgusted with the scene, the kid Renault being pummeled by Jansa. The sight of blood always sickened him anyway. Looking away from the bleachers, he glanced up at a small hill that looked down at the field. The hill was actually huge rock embedded in the landscape, partially covered with moss and also with scrawled obscenities that had to be scrubbed off almost daily. A movement caught Obi's eye. That's when he saw the face of Brother Leon. Leon stood at the top of the hill, a black coat draped around his shoulders. In the reflection of the stadium lights, his face was like a gleaming coin. The bastard, Obi thought. He's been there all the time, I'll bet, watching it all. The face vanished as the darkness fell. The darkness was sudden and deep, like a giant ink blot poured over the bleachers, the platform, the entire field, like the world suddenly wiped out, devastated. God damn it, Archie thought as he stumbled away from the bleachers toward the small utility building where the electrical controls were located. He tripped, fell down, and groped to his feet. Someone brushed past him. The noise from the bleachers was awesome. Kids screaming and shouting, guys tumbling from the seats. Small flames tore at the darkness as matches and cigarette lighters were lit. Stupid, Archie thought. They're all stupid. He was the only one here with a presence of mind to check the cause of the power failure at the control building. Tripping over a fallen body, Archie swiveled his way to the building, arms extended in front of him. As he reached the door, the lights went on again, blinding in their intensity. Dazed, blinking, he flung the door open and encountered Brother Jacques, whose hand was on the switch. Welcome, Archie. I imagine you are the villain here, aren't you? His voice was cool, but his contempt was unmistakable. 38. Jerry? Wet darkness. Funny, darkness shouldn't be wet, but it was, like blood. Jerry? But blood wasn't black, it was red, and he was surrounded by black. Come on, Jerry. Come on where? He liked it here, in the darkness, moist and warm and wet. Hey, Jerry! Voices outside the window calling. Shut the window, shut it. Shut the voices out. Jerry! Something sad in the voice now. More than sad, scared. Something scared in the voice. Suddenly the pain verified his existence, brought him into focus. Here and now. Jesus, the pain. Take it easy, Jerry, take it easy, the goober was saying, cradling Jerry in his arms. The platform was brilliantly lit again, like an operating table, but the stadium was almost empty, a few curious stragglers still hanging around. Bitterly, Goober had watched the guys leaving, chased away by Brother Jacques and a couple of other faculty members. The guys had vacated the place as if leaving the scene of a crime, strangely subdued. Goober had struggled toward the ring in the darkness and had finally reached Jerry as the lights went on. "We better get a doctor," he had yelled at the kid called Obi, Archie's stooge. Obi had nodded, his face pale and ghost-like in the floodlights. "Take it easy," Goober said now, drawing Jerry closer. Jerry felt broken. "Everything'll be all right." Jerry raised himself toward the voice, needing to answer it. He had to answer, but he kept his eyes shut, as if he could keep a lid on the pain that way. But it was more than pain that caused an urgency in him. The pain had become the nature of his existence, but this other thing weighed on him, a terrible burden. What other thing? The knowledge, what he had discovered. Funny how his mind was clear suddenly, apart from his body, floating above the pain. "It'll be all right, Jerry." "No, it won't." He recognized Goober's voice, and it was important to share the discovery with Goober. He had to tell Goober to play ball, to play football, to run, to make the team, to sell the chocolates, to sell whatever they wanted you to sell, to do whatever they wanted you to do. He tried to voice the words, but there was something wrong with his mouth, his teeth, his face. But he went ahead anyway, telling Goober what he needed to know. "They tell you to do your thing, but they don't mean it. They don't want you to do your thing, not unless it happens to be their thing, too. It's a laugh, Goober, a fake. Don't disturb the universe, Goober, no matter what the posters say." His eyes fluttered open, and he saw Goober's face all askew, like on a broken movie film. But he was able to see the concern, the worry on his face. "Take it easy, Goober. It doesn't even hurt anymore. See? I'm floating above the pain. Just remember what I told you. It's important. Otherwise, they murder you." "Why did you do it to him, Archie?" "I don't know what you're talking about." Archie turned away from Brother Jacques and watched the ambulance making its careful progress out of the athletic field, the rotating blue light casting emergency flashings all over the place. The doctor said that Renault may have sustained a fracture of the jaw and there may be internal injuries. X-rays would tell. What the hell, Archie thought, those were the risks of the boxing ring. Jacques swung Archie around. "Look at me when I talk to you," he said. If someone hadn't come to the residence and told me what was going on here, who knows how far it might have gone. What happened to Renault was bad enough, but there was violence in the air. You could have had a riot on your hands the way those kids were stirred up. Archie didn't bother to answer. Brother Jacques probably considered himself a hero for putting out the lights and stopping the fight. As far as Archie was concerned, Jacques had merely spoiled the evening. And Jacques had arrived too late anyway. Renault had already been beaten. Too fast, much too fast. Leave it to that stupid Carter to screw things up. Low blow, for crying out loud. "What have you got to say for yourself, Costello?" Brother Jacques persisted. Archie sighed. Bored, really. "Look, brother, the school wanted the chocolates sold, and we got them sold. This was the payoff. That's all. A fight. With rules. Fair and square." Leon was suddenly there with them, one arm clapped around Jacques' shoulder. "I see you have everything under control, Brother Jacques," he said heartily. Jacques turned a cold face toward his fellow teacher. "I think we barely averted a disaster," he said. There was rebuke in his voice, but a gentle, guarded rebuke, not the hostility he had revealed to Archie. And Archie realized that Leon was still in command, still in the position of power. "Renault will get the best of care, I assure you," Leon said. "Boys will be boys, Jacques. They have high spirits. Oh, once in a while they get carried away, but it's good to see all that energy and zeal and enthusiasm." He turned to Archie and spoke more severely, but not really angry. "You really didn't use your best judgment tonight, Archie. But I realize you did it for the school, for Trinity." Brother Jacques stalked away. Archie and Leon watched him go. Archie smiled inside. But he masked his feelings. Leon was on his side. Beautiful. Leon and the vigils and Archie. What a great year it was going to be. The ambulance's siren began to howl in the night. 39.
"Someday, Archie," Obi said, a warning in his voice. "Someday."
"Cut it out, Obi. Enough preaching tonight. Brother Jacques already delivered a sermon to me," Archie chuckled. "But Leon came to the rescue. Good man, that Leon." They were sitting in the bleachers, watching some of the guys cleaning up the place. This was where they had first seen Renault that afternoon. Archie had selected him for the assignment. The night had grown cold, and Obi shivered slightly. He looked at the goalposts. They reminded him of something he couldn't remember.
"Leon is a bastard," Obi said. "I saw him on the hill over there, watching the fight, enjoying the whole thing."
"I know," Archie said. "I tipped him off. An anonymous phone call. I figured he would enjoy himself. And I also figured that if he was here and part of the proceedings, he'd also be protection for us if anything went wrong."
"Someday, Archie, you'll get yours," Obi said, but the words were automatic. Archie was always one step ahead.
"Look, Obi, I'm going to forget what you did tonight. You and Carter in the black box. What the hell, it was a dramatic moment. And I understand how you felt. My understanding of you and guys like Carter is a marvel to behold." He had lapsed into his phony way of speaking when he wanted to be fancy or sarcastic.
"Maybe the black box will work the next time, Archie," Obi said. "Or maybe another kid like Renault will come along."
Archie didn't bother to answer. Wishful thinking wasn't worth answering. He sniffed the air and yawned.
"Hey, Obi, what happened to the chocolates?"
"The guys raided the chocolates in the confusion. As far as the money's concerned, Brian Cochran has it. We'll have some kind of drawing next week at assembly."
Archie barely listened. He wasn't interested. He was hungry.
"You sure all the chocolates are gone, Obi?"
"I'm sure, Archie."
"You got a Hershey or anything?"
"No."
The lights went off again. Archie and Obi sat there a while, not saying anything, and then made their way out of the place in the darkness.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Chocolate War by Robert Cormier, read for you by Frank Muller. Text copyright 1974 by Robert Cormier. Production copyright 1988, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Hello, this is Jim Dale, narrator of the Harry Potter audiobook series. Listening to audiobooks isn't just great entertainment, it's also a great way for your family to experience and enjoy books together. Studies have shown that listening to stories read aloud helps children build vocabulary, improve their reading skills, and succeed more readily in school. It's an important step on the road to becoming a good reader, and one of the best ways to help ensure a lifelong love of literature for the children you care about. Check your local retailer for the wide selection of audiobooks available from Listening Library. Or if you would like to visit us online for more information, check our website at www.listeninglibrary.com. Thank you, and happy listening.